We're just going to begin, and I'll say this is episode 93 of Our Modern Heritage, the Home and Family Culture podcast. And I'm super excited to have here on the show Jeremy Roadruck. And Jeremy is a best-selling author, Kung Fu master, Pan American champion, former member of the military, former corporate wage slave, and former factory worker. Jeremy Roadruck has been through many seasons and adventures in his life. Today, he's a speaker, author, teacher, and consultant to families, teens, and kids, helping them to speak up and own their voice, creating their own emotional safety and playing games worth winning and share stories worth telling. Jeremy has worked with students ages 3 and up, including students with physical, mental, sensory, or attitude challenges, right? And helping them to play the game of life at a higher level. Welcome, Jeremy.
Well, how you doing, Jody? Glad that we made it. And I just posted on my Facebook, I just posted the link to the YouTube live. So there we
awesome.
Go.
Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. Cool. So yeah, this is new to have it on YouTube. The Facebook connection was finicky. So we're just going around it, working around the technical difficulty. Well,
it's a perfect metaphor for, you know, you want to get results, not be right. You know, so stay focused.
You know, I like that. I love that. So how did you get into this? You know, it sounds like, you know, your journey is so it's going through all these different, you know, ways to end up where you are today with, you know, being an author and talking to kids and teens about, you know, their conflicts in life and empowering them to tell their stories. You know, that's so important. How did you get to this point in your career?
Well, really, it's been a slow evolution, a slow progress. It started from I had a very unpleasant childhood and I went through some stuff. I was unfortunately abused at 5 and 6. Mm. And if you haven't been around young kids that have been through trauma, a lot of times that will shift them intellectually and internally more mature. So they become more sophisticated. They don't really respond to positional authority because I said so, pain, punishment type stuff. Right. They become a lot harder to motivate and encourage. The thing was, nobody knew I had been through it because I had hidden it very well because I had blamed myself for what happened. And so for about 20 years, I was living through a bunch of patterns of anger and security and safety. I couldn't trust anybody else for my security. So I had to kind of manipulate everyone. And because I had a lot of energy before the abuse, I was raised on a leash because I would run into traffic. And I 4 years old, I climbed on the roof of the house. So high energy kid, then you amp in the trauma. And I was just like, you ever play tic-tac-toe with a 7 year old? And for them, it's life and death.
Right? Yeah.
like that was the energy that I brought to everything. And I realized pretty quickly that I was out of alignment. Like I was just too much. I was scaring people. Yeah. So I learned to hold back and I learned to become a mimic and just kind of like, what's going on? Why is this like this? How do I need to show up to stay safe and not get noticed, but not get ignored? And so it made me very, very observant and just had a very interesting way of growing up. I was doing cross-cultural religious studies at 12. I was studying, you know, why is the world the way that it is? And I was really drawn to Buddhist and Confucian and Taoist metaphysics and imagery. Okay. And so that's kind of, I swam from 8 to 13. I had a big battle with my parents for 2 years about quitting swimming. And when I finally quit swimming, I mentally and emotionally quit the family. So I would kind of grunt at them in the hallways and do what I had to do to get what I wanted. But it was kind of a jerk, kind of distant. And barely graduated high school, dropped out of college to work in a factory. But I started Kung Fu at about 20 years old. And that became a place where I could kind of reintegrate myself because come in as egotistical as you want, come in full of your ideas and your theories and your thoughts, and you got a room full of people that are going to hand you your butt in the nicest way possible, but they're going to dump you on the ground and just own you. And so it took away a lot of my defense mechanisms and a lot of the ways that I compensated because they didn't care because they had other ways to deal with me. And so it became a really great place actually to get my body, my mind, my emotions to really start to integrate and start letting go of the defensiveness and the fear and the scarcity. Wow. And as I worked in the martial arts school, you know, I loved being there. I was my first class, I threw up because no boundaries, jumping jacks, push-ups, sit-ups, squats, puke. My Sifu Grandmaster Ming was like, oh, he's not coming back. And then 3 months later, I was 7 days a week. So I was working in the sandpaper factory and I was there every day, every chance I could be, as long as I could be. And, you know, it was really great because he allowed, and he still allows students to just kind of go and explore. And, you know, the thing he did that was really brilliant in the beginning when I first met him is he challenged me. He said, you know, I've been trying to prove this stuff wrong my whole life. You should try it. And it was like, oh yeah, I'm smarter than you. I can do that. And yeah.
Yeah.
I'm still trying to catch up. It's been 24 years. So, it was just a great vehicle and a great way to kind of bring everything back together. And then as I was a junior student, then an intermediate student, I'm helping out in the classes. A lot of the kids that were a little bit harder to reach or didn't really respond to authority, I had a way of getting their attention and we could play reindeer games together. I had a way of influencing them because I could read that energy. And if you need to do the heavy-handed grown-up, you know, let's all be happy, big boys and girls and be everybody friend, wonk, wonk, wonk. Yeah. I've never approached anyone with that kind of energy. And it was just kind of like, dude, that was nice. And I ignore them. And they're like, wait, what? Like someone noticed me?
Yeah.
And it's like dealing with a skittish cat, right? You don't throw a ton of energy at a cat. You just get stuff that influences them like food. And so it's that same idea with the kids. It's just how do you bring them along? And it kind of grew from there. And then as I did this, you know, I love teaching and anything I understand, I can explain to pretty much anybody. So I loved working with the families and the kids and unlocking this deeper wisdom and taking 1500 years of information and how do we translate that into the modern age. And so it took a lot of different experiences that I had growing up and it just let me bring everything together. And so that's why, you know, then after about 15 years, I realized, oh, so I've been doing martial arts and nothing else. Unless you worked where I worked or went to Kung Fu, I wouldn't know who you were. Physically, we understand balance, but in life, there was no balance. And so then I started networking and like growing a school and getting out into the community. And it was really interesting when I went networking, because in the business community, a lot of people do their job, but they're not excited about it. It's not a passion, it's not meaningful for them. It's just a thing they have to do. And I would show up at these places excited and passionate and engaged and curious and all these different things. And so very quickly in the local community it was like, hey, have you met that Jeremy? He's like the, you know, the cha-cha-pa-ha, the kung fu guy. And that's where that monster of the kung fu guy came, is it was the easiest way for people to remember who I was.
Wow. So that is everything about your story is so fascinating. You know, that what stood out to me is this idea that it seems like from a very young age, you were very self-aware, that you were just like, you know, to be able to recognize the way people were responding to you and your high energy, that says a lot about your ability to be self-aware. Cause I think a lot of kids, they don't recognize, or I don't know, maybe they do, maybe you know better than me this, that kids don't necessarily recognize that, I'm overwhelming these people, right? Like this is my high energy is too much. And so when kids come into the Kung Fu and you were working with them, did you notice like what the difference was if kids were self-aware or not, how that impacted their development and their ability to listen?
Yeah. Usually the only kids that are really self-aware are the ones who've been through trauma, because they realize there's a gearing out of place because they've actually matured intellectually, emotionally, they're still held back. They're still regressed. But intellectually, they're further ahead. So they tend to be a little more self-aware. They usually tend to be a little more angry, a little more chip on the shoulder, a little more defensive, a little more sensitive. For most of the kids that I work with, they're honest with where they are and who they are and what they are. And they just go. Cool. That's fine. Yeah. I know where you are. I like Tiggers because I know where you are. I can deal with that. That's easy to guide. Give me an Eeyore and I got to poke you with a stick and try and figure out what's moving you. And then I get an owl who's trying to lecture me and like, dude, you're 7. You don't need to be lecturing me. It's cool. We're good. We got this. So, nice. You know, you get these different personalities. And it's like, great. So first thing I do whenever I work with someone, meet someone in a you know, professional setting, is I start doing assessments on where they are developmentally, intellectually, how they use language, and how they build their model of the world. Are they more auditory, visual, kinesthetic, or conceptual? Because that will then change how I relate to them. And then I also have to do the same thing with the parents. I have to figure out how do the parents learn, because the parents communicate in one way, their kids may or may not receive that. And so what to the parent is a disrespectful or disobedient child may be a differently focused child. And so then kind of nuancing that conversation a little bit to say, well, you know, here's something to consider. And then if you look for this pattern, you may notice. And then that way the parents start to realize, oh, my kid is doing their best. They are trying to listen. I'm making it too complicated.
Wow. So you do coach parents like on getting to know their kids better, right? Like that's, coming back to just knowing them.
Yeah. Well, it's being able to get retention. I want to have someone stay in the martial arts school for a while. Then the parents really have to understand what we're doing. It's not come in, put on fancy pajamas and jump around, go woohoo. I mean, that's really not it. It's about physical, mental, emotional, and social structure and how to build power and strengthen all those places. I mean, there's a great book, it's called The Charisma Myth. And it talks about this idea of charisma and people that you are naturally drawn to. And the authors basically plot it as an X. And they say, there's two factors. You got to have power, the ability to get things done, but then you got to have warmth, because if you just have warmth, people like you and they hang out with you, but they're not drawn to you because you can't get anything done. You're ineffective. But if you're powerful, but have no warmth, no one stays around you very long. You burn people out. You burn through people.
Right.
So charisma is this intersection of these two skills. And so it's like that idea we teach the parents, everything human beings do, it's a skill you can get better with practice, even breathing. We have, 1500 years of Chinese techniques and breathing and how to strengthen the lungs and how to do all kinds of really interesting things. Eventually learn how to get hormone control on purpose. I mean, there's some really cool stuff. The joys of no TV. You got to find something to do to entertain yourself.
Right. Yeah. I love that.
But like imagine if you needed to, as an athlete, you could turn your adrenal glands on, turn them back off. Just you choose a focus and you can just burst the energy. Those types of abilities are available, but it takes a fair degree of body awareness, focus, relaxation, self-control. It requires a bunch of skills to get there. And so for the parents, it's just starting to notice these patterns and going, oh, I'm coming at it this way. I'm coming this way and my kid's coming at it this way. I see why we're crashing. And then how can we have a more harmonious experience at home?
So is that when you say parents come at it this way, are you talking about like parents are trying to be more aggressive or parents are trying to be more results oriented? Whereas the kids are like, hey, mom and dad, I don't know what you want out of me. I'm just trying to be myself or figure out myself or, things like that. Is that more like what you mean? Like they're trying to force this agenda on the kids saying you are supposed to behave a certain way.
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes you'll get parents that are very auditory. So I had a family, it's a mom, dad, daughter, and a son. And mom, dad, daughter are all auditory learners. The son is 5 and he's visual kinesthetic. And so whenever there's a family problem, they're going to sit around, they're going to talk about their problems. Right. And the 5-year-old is going,
boring.
And the reason is, it's not that he doesn't care. It's not that he doesn't love his parents. It's not that they don't love him. Is that he's not sophisticated enough in his language to hear what they're saying and then build a visual representation. Solution.
Right.
Write down the conversation. As you're going, you draw pictures about what you're talking about. And now he's more engaged because he can see what's happening. Right.
Wow.
And so it's not that the parents don't love their kids. It's just a mismatch in communication styles.
Wow.
Right. Wow. And then there are, though, the parents that are in positional authority and shut up and do it the way I say, when I say, how I say, look me in the eyes when I'm talking to you. And
But you're talking about like real parents who are trying to be authoritative, trying to be, have a balance in this relationship and the responsibility of parent-child relationship, who are they just don't quite understand those different communication styles.
Oh yeah. 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 I get kids that, my kid's not focused. No, they're focused. They're just focused on not what you want them focused on.
Right.
You're boring and there's ants eating gum. They're going to go watch the ants.
Yeah.
I get it. I'm still 12 in a lot of ways. I get it. It's how can you engage your kids and meet them at their level versus expect them to come to your level? And to be fair, it's a two-way street. Your kids need to stretch a little bit to work on their patience muscles and self-control muscles. It's not a parents do everything, kids do nothing, of course.
Yeah, absolutely.
But as a leader, you got to understand your team.
Wow. So you're saying like the parents are, that's something that I talk about a lot, is how parents are really like the culture leader in our home. Mm-hmm. We lead out in the expectations and the feelings. I like this idea about the charisma, balancing power and warmth, because I think that's a really good skill for parents to learn how to do in order to lead out as the culture leaders in their home that have that balance of power and warmth. because there's a two-way street. Another thing I talk about a lot is trust. Mm-hmm. That it's a it's a two-way relationship to have trust on both sides, right? Like mm-hmm. a child, it wants to trust their parent that they're going to love them and coach them through stuff, but then the parent trusts the child to then develop as a person as well. Right, so right. Do you see that relationship in your practice and
oh yeah
or otherwise?
Oh yeah. Cause your kids need some level of consistency from you, and little kids have a really hard time separating their identity from their behavior. So, you know, I did something bad versus I am bad. Yes. And because they've watched enough TV shows, they know how bad characters are supposed to act. So if they take the identity that I am bad, cause I'm always getting in trouble, I'm always getting lectured, I'm always getting punished, I'm always getting time out, then they know how to behave cause they see it on the TV shows. And that becomes their identity. So we have to make that separation of, I love you, I don't love what you're doing. And then, then that creates that, it creates a break in that. And they go, wait a minute, what? Yeah, I love you. You're amazing. I think you're fantastic. The sun shines out your butt. And you need to stop chasing the cat with a flamethrower. That's not okay. Flamethrowers go outside. You know,
yeah.
it's that idea that it's helping the kid go, oh, okay. There's a right time and a right place for this behavior. Evie got in a lot of trouble. Evie's my 5-year-old daughter. She got in trouble a couple nights ago because they were coming to get me from the martial arts school. And she had two little plastic My Little Ponies. And for whatever reason, she took it in her head to throw them and it hit mom in the head. And when it hit mom, as mom's driving, she thought the car had been in a car accident. So immediately she went to a 10. And so for the next 20 minutes on the way home, Evie was crying because mom was really unhappy with that.
Yeah, yeah.
And that sort of the thing, it's like, Evie, we never throw things in the car. We don't throw things when people aren't ready to catch. But in that moment, we need to have her to have some fear of her behavior and her consequences.
Right. That's one of those things
that's like, yeah, that can be life-threatening. Because if mom had lost control and the car had swerved, everybody could have been dead. So we need to have her to have some fear there. That I'm going to be okay with that. However, if we were at home and then she said, hey, catch, and then she threw a little bit too hard and one of those things hit us in the head and then we had that same level of energy, that's probably going to be inappropriate in that context. It's like, you know, we could say, hey, that's not okay. Throw softer. Or we coach her on her throwing. But we don't need to have that emotion in 25 minutes of crying. We don't need that energy in a different situation. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely have witnessed where in my family as well as others, that imbalance of reaction to a situation where you're going, that did not merit a total meltdown, right. You know, like from the parent or child.
Right. And I was going to say the parents can melt down just as much as the kids. We have those moments of just, rah! But, you know, in our family, we've made it. It's okay. If you start to have a meltdown like that, just say, it's not you. I'm outside. And we leave. You know, it's not you. And then
a lot of times it's triggered by other things going on. And then it just so happens that the kids trigger.
Yeah.
You were the spark. Happens.
Yeah. You were the spark. There was already a keg there waiting and you sparked it. I'm sorry that happened. That wasn't about you at all. You know, and it's okay as adults to apologize to your kids too, when you lose control, because then you're modeling for them. It's okay to apologize.
Yes, exactly.
You're setting that standard.
Wow. I love that so much. That's definitely, I totally agree with that, because I think that, you know, if your children see you apologizing, then it's possible. Like, I think that comes back to speaking to your point about how this level of me, if it's, I am bad versus I did something bad. Mm-hmm, when you can apologize, then you're recognizing, acknowledging and modeling that, oh, I did something. And here I am now. Correcting that thing or attempting to correct this thing.
Yeah. I'm offering the opportunity. I'm making restitution. You know, I want to get back to warm, big, happy with you. And then we can have that conversation.
Wow. So I want to go back to something you'd said about the skills of, mm-hmm. of managing your body, your emotions, you know, mm-hmm. things like that. Can you tell me more about what you mean by those, the kinds of skills and what are they? What are more, you know, go into more detail about what those skills are.
Sure. So one of the things to understand is we don't have emotions. We do emotions, and more correctly, emotions do us, right? Mm-hmm. So if I put a screen and I put a person behind this screen and I said, okay, this person is depressed. What do they look like? I'm going to give you $1 million if you get it right. Could you describe what they look like? Right? Because human beings, about 90%, we do emotions the exact same way. The chest is going to be down. The face is going to be down. Breathing is going to be slow. The body's going to be soft, low muscle tone, low voice. Like there's this whole series of things we do. It's like a recipe. So think about you're going to make a cake. only take the sugar out and put in just salt, no sugar at all. It's going to change the cake.
Yeah.
So we have these different emotional states. And because of those emotional states, then they will start to drive certain behaviors, certain thought processes, certain neurological structures activate in our brain. There's all these really cool things that come together. So because of that, we can start to then consciously choose how we connect to our emotions and how we show up. And when we realize sometimes we just, it catches us and we get interrupted, we get drawn into, we can take a deep breath, we can break that pattern and we can choose different. And so a couple of ways to do that. Number one, most powerful, most important thing is deep breathing inside your belly. Take a deep breath, breathe low and slow. What that does is it takes you out of your sympathetic nervous system, which is the fight or flight, and it moves you into your parasympathetic, which is your digestion and rest. And so you're literally switching your internal gears and your nervous system out of tunnel vision, adrenaline dump, cortisol, stress hormones, and you're pulling yourself back from that edge. So first thing always is take a deep breath, shoulders up, shoulders back, shoulders down, relax into the tension. And if you start from that, then you begin to center yourself physically, which then you get centered mentally and emotionally. And so that's one of the things we teach the students is breathing over emotion. But then we also have mind over emotion, changing what you're thinking about. Maybe try to think about when you're arguing with somebody or upset with somebody, try to think it through from their point of view and why they think that. Because human beings are always reasonable, even if the reasons don't make sense. The process of the reasoning always does. Yeah, so even somebody who is, you know, schizophrenic, somebody who's having hallucinations, because of that experience, they will then do a reasonable course of action based on that first cause. If you understand the first cause, you go, oh, this makes sense now. And then we can redirect that or we can guide that. So deep breathing, changing what we think. Another one is start changing our language, right? Instead of getting frustrated with my kids, get fascinated with your kids. Instead of I'm so angry, I'm so irritated, I'm so peeved, I'm so tinkled. Because when you change the word, it changes the resources you call out of yourself.
Wow. Yeah.
Right. So you can change how you show up in the moment. And then it's easier to, you know, as a parent, I got to drop the hammer. Really? You got to drop the hammer? Really? How about you just put your foot down? Okay. Well, how about we just make it clear? How about we just set some guidelines? How about we get on the same page? Right. Because those are all similar frames of reference, just different levels of power that we can choose to access in that moment. And it's all self-talk. It's all just language. There's like 3,000 words in the English language for emotion. And most of us only use 20.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So how many other things can you add? Instead of getting hungry, get Epicurean, you know, get your kids thinking a little bit more. Shoe obfuscation in your conversation. So I used to read this.
You lost me that one. I love that.
Issue obfuscation. It means make it simple in the most not simplest way
to say it. The most complicated way. I love that. First of all, I love that you break it down, you know, scientifically. Like this is legitimately scientifically proven that if you breathe and you get out of your sympathetic, you know, fight or flight mode, then you can think more clearly. That's something that, you know, I talk about with, you know, my 9-year-old, he loves to be in his fight or flight mode. And I have to constantly, I'm like, hey, bud, take a deep breath so you can have control over what you're thinking.
Because adrenaline is powerful. And it's addictive. And it also nerfs your digestion. It'll keep him small and underweight if he doesn't learn to control it. And he can actually fatigue his adrenals. And he can cause all kinds of longer term trauma as he gets older too, because his endocrine system is under stress.
Wow. Now I'm freaked out. No, just kidding. But yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, he's definitely my kid that doesn't eat as much as my other kids. And he's constantly, and it's not, I'm not sure like where it started. I mean, we definitely have a history in our little family of depression and anxiety and things like that it could have stemmed from that. And that's something that we're working on healing and working through as a family, you know? Right. But it's definitely something where that it's, you know, some of the things that we try to implement are, you know, hey, let's get present here. You know, let's take some deep breaths. Mm-hmm. Let's get present. Let's ask some questions that get them thinking rather than reacting and things like that. Yep. So that, you know, we just start to calm down and just constantly trying to connect with him, you know, just.
Well, a great question you can ask him is what else could it mean? Whatever he's upset about or focused on or fixated on, go, hey, that's great. What else could it mean?
Wow.
well, what do you mean? Well, it could mean that, but what else could it mean? And it gets him going sideways now. And that takes the emotion down because you start to get curious and then you start to, you shift that focus, right? And so as parents, one of our biggest powers is the power of questions, because whether you agree with it or not, whether the question is real or not, your brain always answers the questions. Like, do you still have a polka dotted tree in your backyard? And your brain just answered it.
That's what
brains do. They go, there's never been a tree like that in my backyard. What? But the brain always answers the questions it's given. So you could even tell him when he's getting worked up about something, say, now's not the time to calm down. We'll do that in a few minutes. But for right this second, what else could it mean? Mm. And when I said now is not the time to calm down, the brain deletes the word not and it just heard now calm down. So I'm talking to his unconscious mind to slow him down a little bit. And then we can now ask the question to focus him sideways. And I've taken him off that point that he was at. We're switching gears down and then we're sliding sideways. This is where it's helpful having a hypnotherapy background.
Wow. And does it help to even, when you say it's not the time to calm down, do you think that also gives him permission to be like, oh, it's okay to feel this way?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I very rarely make people wrong for what they feel. What you feel is what you feel. It may be based on wrong information, but the feeling is real and you're allowed to feel it. With my wife, she was in a previous relationship and she was made wrong for her feelings all the freaking time. And the person she was with would be like, come back and talk to me when you're in control. And I'm like, nah, let's have that fight. Let's go right now. I'm fine. I'm not scared because I love you. I'm going to be here one way or the other. Let's go. And just that, giving her that freedom to allow her access to her emotion, not make her wrong for that. She's more open with me than she has been anybody in her whole entire life. And it's been a great treasure to experience that. But I don't know how not to be otherwise, because you're equal with me and we're together in this and you're my teammate and you're allowed to feel what you feel. I'm allowed to feel what I feel. Doesn't make it right, but it is. So let's go.
How do you do that? How do you approach that and then keep your own feelings level? I mean, obviously you have those skills, but what's some tips and ideas? Like, your child or your spouse is upset, they're screaming, they're angry or whatever. They have these big feelings, you know, how do you like not take that personally? Or okay.
No, I'm a problem.
So what is your response? Like,
sometimes I throw back energy and sometimes it's not pretty. And we've had some pretty intense arguments. I have been hit with a banana once, a whole clump one time. I said something and I got flung, this whole thing of bananas got flung at me. And then we both started laughing because that was a great pattern interrupt. So part of it is I'm allowed to feel what I feel and I'm going to react and I'm going to spark occasionally too. But then it's take a deep breath, get centered. And that's a discipline to just choose whatever else is going on. Don't say the thing back that I could, because my wife and I have made an agreement. We would rather be in love first, be right second. And so because of that, sometimes you have to bite your tongue and just shut up and listen and let the other person just spew and let them get it out, because then you start listening for their heart, not listening for their words. And then you begin to understand, oh, this is venting about something, nothing to do with me. I powder kegged. Okay, cool. I know how to show up now. Or no, I did fail. I forgot this piece and it set things up and it made things more complicated and I need to own that, apologize. And then what can I do to resolve the situation? So there's always she's communicating to me. I know she's coming from positive intent and she wants me to understand what she's going through. It's not a personal, but it feels that way. And I feel like I let her down and I'm upset with myself. Now I've got to separate the I'm upset with myself versus what does she need? What do I need? How do I need to show up?
Yeah.
And so it's being able to take that deep breath, center yourself. And then also, you know, we do pattern interrupts. We intentionally just do these non sequiturs and do these random things to break the person's emotional pattern, not make it wrong, but just kind of interrupt it. You know, like somebody's really upset, you just pour water on their head. Because now they're mad and wet. But you know, if it's summertime and we're outside and now we can have a water fight for a few minutes, you know, I mean, it's just things like that. So yes. Not always the answer to everything is dump water in their head, but
well, I get this idea of the pattern interrupt, because like, a book that I read that I really appreciate is it's called The Powerful Engagement. Mm-hmm. And that one, I really love it because it talks about that and how important it is that, you know, we have these like peaks and valleys in our energy. And mm-hmm. So to honor the valleys, to just do like a pattern interrupt to say, I've been going for the last hour, 2 hours, however long, and now I need this interrupt to be able to recover and reestablish, you know, let myself go into this, you know, the ebb and flow of the natural, you know, the way that our energy naturally ebbs and flows.
Absolutely.
So I can definitely understand that, that idea. Like if you guys are in a, you know, the height of the stress sequence of the ebb and flow, then it's time to have that pattern interrupt so that you can just.
Yeah. And label it too, because you ritualize it. And I need to go in the cave. I need to shut down for 5 minutes. I need to go do corpse meditation, right? Give each other permission to take those outs and get your recharge. It's not a denouement of you. And I think you're ineffective or incapable, or I don't want to be around you. It's for me to show up more fully. I need to go shut down for a few minutes.
Yeah.
Cool. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, we have time for that. Look at the schedule. Here's what's going on. Here's what needs to happen next. Yeah, absolutely. Go take some time. And we can start to tell kind of when one of us starts to run on fumes a little bit and be like, hey, you're fuming. Why don't you go get some quiet time. Go watch an episode of, go listen to some meditation, go shut off.
Go something that's funny. Yeah. Laugh.
We do the same thing for the kids. You know, if the kids need to recharge and they just need a few minutes. So that's when I met my stepson, Jamie, he was 3 and you know, so when he was 4 and he was starting to resist naps a little bit, but we gave him this idea. I gave him this idea. Well, human beings are like batteries. You know, when the game runs low because the battery's low, you got to recharge. Well, taking a nap recharges your battery. And then he started to become more aware of like, he's like, my batteries are low. I need to go recharge.
Wow. So
his way of saying, I need to go take a nap. And now my daughter is 5 and she's still taking naps, but she's got a thyroid issue and was 14 weeks early. So she does the same thing. She's like, I'm getting tired. I think I need a nap. And they're just starting to recognize a little bit extra whiny, a little bit rough around the edges, a little bit just fighting everything. And everything is what we call squeaky wheel. All right, you need to go recharge. It's cool. We got you. Why don't you go flop down for about half an hour, and then we'll come and get you.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. You hear that, everybody? There's a tip to get your toddlers, your preschoolers to take a nap. You walk away with nothing else from this conversation. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Just go recharge your batteries. It's cool.
It's so important. You're exactly right. I homeschool my kids. And so it's like, you know, we can't just like go all day long. You just can't. It's not healthy. It's not normal. And so, you know, throughout the day, it's like, oh, okay. I think it's time to go get a snack, or I think it's time to sing some songs instead of pushing through the books or whatever. I think it's time to, you know, let's watch a funny video that just kicks our giggles in gear or something.
Yeah. 5 minute dance party. Go.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. They need to do that regular too. They need to do 5 minute dance party, 2 minute. Oh, dance.
Absolutely.
They need that.
Absolutely.
Because kids process and they digest intellectually, emotionally through random association and free play, not through structure. So they need that to just have the neurons bouncing into each other and bouncing around is how they process. So they need more time unstructured and just free to do a careen around. So yeah, definitely get that. And adults do more than we get as well.
So do you do this in your work at all with the kids that you work with? You do a lot of damage control from public school.
I wouldn't call it damage control. It's not even, I don't even think of it as, I don't think of it as damage. I don't think of it as control. We just look at alignment.
Okay. Alignment. Okay. I like that. That's right, a better way.
If a bad guy is going to attack you, right? You got this big energy coming at you. I can try and suppress that energy. I can try and stop that energy, which takes more energy. Or I could just redirect it, right? Catch it. It requires a better sense of timing, a better sense of awareness. But if I can catch that energy and just as it's coming towards me, move it over here slightly, lot less effort, and allow them to kind of overextend themselves, then they have all kinds of openings that are self-evident, very easy, right? Not that we're lazy, we're just efficient because it's better marketing. Mm-hmm. But it's the idea that, you know, if I have to correct something, that presupposes it's wrong. So I don't correct anything. I just offer adjustments. And then if it makes sense, if it feels contiguous, if it works for you, that makes your life easier, great, use it. So with the kids, it's just going into different conversations or different directions or different energies and just exploring that and going, well, that's an interesting point of view. Here's one way to see it, but what about this? And then I can give 2 or 3 other variations and then allow them to come to their own conclusions because their life and their consequences, not mine. So it's not my job to tell them how to live or what's important. I can't answer that, right? Same when it comes to self-defense. I can't tell you how far you're going to go to defend your life because it's not my life. I know how far I'll go. I have my answers and I have questions for you. And as you give me your answers, I can help you develop skills. You know, will you hurt another human being? Will you maim them? Will you make them cease to exist? are you willing to go that far? And if you're not, that changes things. But if you are, that changes things too. And so I can't tell you what you should do. I can't tell you in the heat of the moment, because it's your life and someone else's life. I can just provide context and guidance. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I like that. I like that. It gives me clarity to, you know, something that I, going back to this whole trust concept that I like to talk about, because, you know, when I talk about family culture, I use this analogy that it's like a road trip, and you have your identities, your vehicle, things like that. And actually the fuel of your vehicle is trust, and it gets you going forward. Because if you are trying to put fear or manipulation or anything like that in your vehicle, you're going to stall. You're not going to grow. And I like that this idea, like saying don't put a negative connotation on things, because it's just, you know, you're going in a direction, not trying to run away from your fear or the things that are you're trying to go towards something that's productive. And that takes trust, that takes faith, it takes, you know, going forward with intention rather than being reactive to something that you're interpreting as negative.
Correct. And a lot of well-meaning different types of structures that people put around things, they try to do and drive a certain direction, but there's an implicit dichotomy in there that sometimes they forget. And so I try to avoid that stuff and not force things into it has to be this way or that way. You know, like, we don't want our kids to fail. Well, no, they need to fail. You move through failure to arrive at success. What? Because people have this idea, you know, failure is over here, success is over here, and you go away from one towards the other. No, success is here and it's wrapped in failure, and you go through different types of failure to learn exactly what not to do anymore until you arrive at the result of what you do want to do. And so then it's like, what did you learn? What are you not going to do again? Fantastic. You're still alive. Great. Game on. Keep going. Wow. And you destigmatize, because you watch a little kid, they're learning to walk. They fall down in the kitchen. They don't go, I can't walk in the kitchen. Then they fall down in the living room and go, I can't walk in the living room. They don't do that, because their goal is, I want to walk. This crawling thing is okay, but I want to walk. That looks cool. But in life, well, you didn't succeed with swimming, and you didn't succeed with baseball, and you didn't succeed with whatever the thing. And we contextualize the result versus the, well, what did I really want? And like you said, finding the right vehicle that's going to get me there, that wasn't as comfortable as, right? Versus, well, you always quit everything. Well, I quit the things that don't enrich my soul. I'm still looking for the things that enrich my soul, right? So it's just staying kind of focused on that outcome and not make wrong the things that you're not doing anymore, because what you might not like, somebody else might love. We're dealing with this with Evie, because when certain foods, she's like, that's disgusting. I'm like, hey, that's not a nice thing to say, because somebody may really love that food. So you can just say, that's not for me. You can say, that's not my favorite. You can say, no, thank you. Those are much better things, because you could hurt someone's feelings because they offer you something that means a lot to them. And then you say, that's disgusting. Would you want someone to say that to you? Well, no. Oh, okay. So if you don't like it, don't do it. And so we're building with her kind of that awareness to, it's okay to have standards. It's okay to have boundaries, but it doesn't mean you have to rub everybody else's faces in your standards.
Wow. That so much of what you just said, I'm like, yes, yes, yes. That's awesome. So thank you for sharing that. I just, especially this idea of destigmatizing things and not having this definitive, you know, but having a balance around, you know, this is what's right for me or not. Mm-hmm. And this is a process that I'm going through to discover myself and my capabilities.
Absolutely.
You know, and things like that. Not that, because as soon as you start putting like finite labels on things, right? I'm stupid, or I'm a failure, or these kinds of things. Again, that goes back to what you were saying about when we punish ourselves, we'll be saying, I did something, or I'm bad, right? Versus I did something bad.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. Your identity starts to shift. And then the most powerful thing inside of us is the desire to maintain our identity. How do we define ourselves? We will self-sabotage to get back. Right? Kids that are raised in stressful environments, kids that are raised on stress hormones, that's what they're used to. Then they get into a healthy environment where there's no stress. They get bored. They get, this is meaningless. This is stupid. I don't know what to do, because they're so used to running on cortisol and adrenaline and noradrenaline. They're so used to having all this anxiety and stuff. When they don't have it, it doesn't feel real. It feels false. Like, they're waiting for it. It's going to go back to how it normally is, because that's how they grew up. Right. And so they self-sabotage perfectly healthy situations, perfectly amazing relationships. They destroy because their biochemical levels are set to run at a higher stress environment, unless, and that's where you do things like meditation can help to kind of reset that internal chemistry and that association of those chemicals. But we're seeing a lot of kids that there's turmoil at home, there's stress at home, and then they're creating that because that's what's comfortable to them. That's what they know as normal. And so a lack of that stuff is weird. And people who grew up in a peaceful environment go, what are you doing? You're causing so much drama. You're making things so harder for everyone. Why do you have to be so jealous and argumentative? And they're going, but that's like normal. If you're not jealous, you don't care.
Wow.
Yeah. Models of the world are incredible. When you start noticing how people model their version of the world and go, well, that's very interesting perspective.
Huh. And to look at it as saying, this is an interesting perspective, not you're toxic or you know, things like that. Or
if you want to influence somebody, you got to have some sort of rapport and some sort of relationship. And if you judge them, you kill your ability to do anything.
Yeah.
So how does it help? Say, well, you're toxic. Okay, great. F you. Your life is all pansies and butterflies, right? And all that does is that it just cuts people apart and disconnects more. And it adds more to the problem of what's going on.
So I love that topic. That is definitely something that I get excited about when you start throwing around judgments, you create barriers. And I absolutely agree with you but I think as parents, it's so tempting to judge. And I just want to like knock parents on the head, like, stop it, just stop it. Like,
then what should they judging. Do? Instead of judging, what should you do?
That is the question that I was going to ask you. Like, so where's that balance though?
Yeah. Well, it's easy. You stop judging, you start evaluating.
Okay.
Because when you evaluate something, you're looking at, right? So if we go back and study natural medicine and you look at where like aspirin came from, I believe it came out of like white willow bark, and they isolated out this compound and said, this compound's super awesome and it does all this great thing. And now we got this aspirin, yay. And now, century later, we're going back to the original source going, wait, there's all these other compounds that buffered it in context that, oh, that had another impact that we didn't fully realize because they were so focused on what was the efficacy of the drug. They wanted to get the most powerful version, but now because it's the most powerful, it's like running a lightning bolt through people sometimes and it causes other impacts. So there's this context that matters. So take tobacco from the Native American tradition. It was used as part of a religious situation and ritualism. Took that out and just made it this thing. And people just kind of, went gonga with it. And again, causes impacts. Native Americans didn't really have issues with cancer, but they weren't smoking cigarettes on a day-to-day basis. It was a medicinal purpose. It was a magical purpose. It was a spiritual purpose. And so when we take something from one context and we put it into another, we have to ask ourselves two big questions. Number one, is it attainable? Meaning, can we even make it fit? And then number two, is it sustainable, or we call the ecology of it? So I take this out of one situation. I see somebody in their life doing a certain thing and go, oh, that looks really cool. That looks really interesting. Let me take that and put it into my life and then see how does it work. Mm-hmm. And does it work? Does it enhance or does it come with costs? Does it impact? Because then if it starts to draw me down, if it starts to limit my life, that's not something I'm going to do, but I can have gratitude for that person showing me a model of humanity. 7.5 billion people means 7.5 billion styles of human. Mm-hmm. That doesn't work for me. It seems to be working for them to some degree. That doesn't work for me, but at least I had that awareness now. So I can choose not to do that. And I can say thank you to them. I can have gratitude and appreciation for that. I can evaluate that in my life and go, that's not something that works for me. And then I stop. And it doesn't work for anybody else and no one should have access to it. And we need to ban that thing and get the government involved and we need to tax it. And people stack all of this control.
Yep.
And it's like, but you can't control any of that stuff. All you can control is your own life. And all you can influence is the people that you can influence. So back up, slow down. Don't take that next jump. Just say, this doesn't work for me. And here's why. And here's where I got that reference. And here's what I appreciate about that. Here's what I understand from that. And then you stop.
Yeah.
Because
don't
then
attach a story to it. Don't attach more meaning to it than it needs.
Well, you attach the story of gratitude and you say, and that's where it ends. Because now I can evaluate that situation and go, does that work for me or not? And then it allows you to be less personal, because the moral judgment about who's right or who's wrong, who's better, who's worse, there's so much context in that. the way our body works, our conscious mind runs somewhere between 50 and 137 bytes of data a second. Our unconscious mind is somewhere between 2 million and 11 million bytes of data a second, right, which means that there's literally in any given moment, millions upon millions upon millions of different interpretations of every single second of your entire life. So maybe don't get so upset or so attached or so quick to be so judgmental and so stuck on one point, because there's a lot of other things going on you might not be aware of. Wow. And that allows that distance and kind of step back for a second and just, okay, I don't have to run that far that fast.
Take those deep breaths, get your neurological about it.
That's right. That's right. Get centered, because then you start to realize there's a bunch of stuff, politics, marketing, news media, they're all designed to get us tilting at windmills. They want to get a limbic response. They want to get us in a stress response, because then emotion goes high, intelligence goes low, and people make emotional knee-jerk reactions. That's good for controlling people. I don't like being controlled. I don't want to have to control anybody else. So how can I help you to have more of your own control, and you can make your own choices? You can live your own life, and your life and my life, and enriches both of us. We both win. That's the game.
Wow. I love that. Thank you. Wow. This is, thank you, Jeremy. This has been really awesome. And like so much, I think we could go on and on. I mean, even just that you brought up media literacy in this discussion is like, oh yes, they want us to be polarized. That's the point. I mean, there's so much that we can learn about this, so much we can understand, and how we interact with our children, how we interact with our family members, and how much it speaks to our family culture. You know, when we want to have an intentional, that's what I talk about. I talk about having an intentional family culture. And to me, that means like what you're saying, be present, be mindful, be aware, and just come from a place of evaluation and compassion. And balancing that power and warmth of how you interact with each other. So thank you. Thank you so much. So where can my audience find you and learn more about all this?
Well, I'm kind of everywhere. I have not picked a social media to go dominate yet and do all that stuff. So I am on Facebook. There's Jeremy R. The Kung Fu Guy is my personal. Jeremy Roderick is my professional. And I kind of post in both places. Instagram at Kung Fu Guy Jeremy, YouTube at Kung Fu Guy Jeremy. I have the Parenting Program Show podcast that comes out on Tuesdays. And what else? I have a best-selling book, Your Best Child Ever, Is This Game Worth Winning? I'll give you guys the links for that. It's available for free. You can go buy it on Amazon if you want. That's nice. Or you can get the free PDF as a digital download. Just put your email in and you can download the PDF.
Oh, cool.
So there's a bit.ly for that. And then I'm also starting an online program. Oh, I have a parenting group on Facebook that is win-win parenting, win/win parenting. Mm-hmm. And then I have an online course, and I'm also doing some one-on-one consulting with people that are having some challenges, and just how can we get some resolution in your family, get better communication, better energy flow, better resonance with each other. Because I see a lot of families with a lot of love, and it's just a skills mismatch. And it's or it's fear. Parents came up in a hard situation. I don't want my kids to be in that same situation, but absent any other models, we default to what we've experienced under stress, right? So we find ourselves, every parent I know of has always run something where they swore they would never say this, and then something happens and they're spewing their mom or they're spewing their dad at their kids inside their head saying, shut up, shut up, shut up. Stuff is spewing out because that they haven't replaced the model. So you'll run the program. Same thing we see in self-defense. If we don't teach people how to get out of grabs, they panic, they freeze, they run certain patterns until we replace the training. And then it's like, oh, they get so much more power.
Wow. That's awesome. That's what this whole message about when I started investigating about family culture, that's what that comes back to, you know, whatever we grew up with that perpetuates until we do a life pattern interrupt, right? And going, this has to stop. I don't want this.
When we grow up and we think that's normal, whether we liked it or we hated it unconsciously, that is normal.
Yeah.
Right. There's a movie by Terry Gilliam, and he comes out like in the beginning of the movie and kind of explains the point of it. But it gets pretty dark. But there's a dad and he's a drug addict, and the daughter's like helping him do drugs, and then he ends up dying and she doesn't know he's dead for like 3 days.
Oh my goodness.
But his point was the resilience of the human spirit, because she didn't know that wasn't normal.
Right.
right? Because for her, that's just what dads do, and that's what daughters do, and that's just normal. And so that's where we have to be really careful about that judgment stuff, because what we think everybody should know, that's what I struggled with as a kid. What I thought everybody should know, nobody knew. Because I realized at six, what you say and what you mean are two separate things. Why? And nobody could tell me. No one knew what I was even asking about when I tried to explain it, because they didn't understand.
It was so normal to them.
Yeah. What's the bifurcation of language? There's implicit and explicit. And then you get in transactional analysis, and there's the child, the adult, and the parent, and there's different levels of communication. Like I understand all that stuff now, but as a kid back then, so much confusion. And it's like, why?
Kids are so literal. They don't get all that stuff.
That's one of the things. Little kids are literal. Teens are not. And that's one of the hallmarks when you have a child that switches from child to teen.
Hmm.
So when you have
we could do a whole other episode on that, I think.
When you have a six-year-old who's not literal, that's usually they're either really brilliant or something has happened and they've switched gears before they were supposed to. Because you're not really supposed to go to teenage brain until somewhere between 10 and 12.
Wow. Okay. Wow. Okay, guys. Go find Jeremy Rodrug. Go find
I've been doing this for 35 years. Where I live.
That's awesome. Cool. Well, thank you so much for being here on the show and sharing wisdom and energy. And I really appreciate it. Thank you so much, Jeremy.
Absolutely. It's been a blast. Thank you, Jody.